Good morning and welcome to today's program. My name is Katie O'Connor and I'm Director of Policy Development and Programming at the American Constitution Society. I want to start by thanking the Open Society Foundations for hosting us this morning. And for those of you not familiar with the American Constitution Society, we are a national network of lawyers, scholars, law students, judges, and policymakers who believe that the law should be a force to improve the lives of all people. ACS works for positive change by shaping debate on vitally important legal and constitutional issues through the development and promotion of high-impact ideas. If you support these efforts and are not a formal part of our network, I encourage you to become a member of ACS today. Now, for the past 50 years, the Supreme Court has regularly struggled with the limits on how a state can redraw its legislative and congressional districts. The court opened the door to claims about redistricting in 1962 with Baker versus Carr, and over the following 2 years established the one person, one vote standard. In the 1990s, with Shaw versus Reno and Miller versus Johnson, the court set limits on what it termed racial gerrymandering. And finally, while the court decided in 1986 in Davis versus Bandemer that partisan gerrymandering claims are justiciable, it has since then repeatedly declined, most recently in Lulac versus Perry, to set justiciable standards for such cases. With this backdrop, today we will discuss the court's most recent foray into the world of redistricting. On Wednesday, the court will hear oral arguments in the cases of Alabama Legislative Black Caucus versus Alabama, and Alabama Democratic Conference versus Alabama. Two cases that challenge Alabama's 2012 legislative redistricting plans as unconstitutional racial gerrymanders. The challengers to the plans claim that the state unconstitutionally classified black voters in violation of the Equal Protection Clause, while the state asserts that the use of race was necessary to comply with the Voting Rights Act and with one person, one vote. To lead us through the discussion of the cases and their potential impact on future gerrymandering or redistricting jurisprudence, we have a true expert and a dedicated advocate, Julie Fernandez. Julie is a senior policy analyst at the Open Society Foundations, where she works to influence public policy in support of the protection of civil and human rights in the United States. Prior to her current position, Julie was Deputy Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Justice, where she was responsible for oversight of the division's work in the areas of voting rights, federal compliance with Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, and international human rights. For more than 6 years before that, Julie was the Senior Policy Analyst and Senior Counsel at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. And before her job with the Leadership Conference, she served as counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, working primarily on legal and policy issues related to voting rights, international human rights, and police misconduct. She also served as a trial lawyer in the housing and voting sections of the Civil Rights Division. Please join me in welcoming Julie Fernandez, who will introduce the rest of our distinguished panel.
Thank you, Katie, and welcome to OSF, everyone. I'm glad to see you all here to talk about this incredibly interesting and important case before the court this week. It's kind of like a voting rights lawyer's just sort of fun time, even though it has huge implications for all of us and for our democracy. So I want to thank ACS, too, for bringing us here today and thank my own office for hosting us. So I want to briefly give you a sense of, Katie told you, what we're here to talk about. And what makes this case kind of a fun case for we voting rights junkies is it kind of has it all. The case brings race, politics, redistricting, gerrymanders, the Voting Rights Act, the Constitution, all kind of mixed up together in a way that is potentially important and potentially could be dangerous for those of us who are interested in kind of preserving and improving our democracy. And it also comes in the midst of several conversations the court is having about voting rights, including the role of race in our political system, the limits of constitutional political gerrymandering, the use of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act to challenge practices under a vote denial theory, and that's actually most fundamentally the role of Congress and the courts in protecting the integrity of our political system. What is Congress's role? That was one of the big issues at stake in Shelby County versus Holder. What is the court's role? The big question the court has in the political gerrymandering cases. These are all kind of coming together in our conversation today. But we're very, very lucky that we have this great panel who's going to guide us through this conversation, so we'll leave knowing a lot more than we do right now. First to my right, we have Wendy Weiser. Wendy is the director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, a longtime voting rights advocate, litigator, and civil rights advocate and litigator. John Greenbaum, the chief counsel and senior deputy director at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. John directs all of the litigation program at the Lawyers Committee now. He's an expert, though, in voting rights and elections work. Also next to him, we have John Gore, two Johns, who's an associate at the law firm of Jones Day. He's a litigator who focuses primarily on appellate advocacy and complex civil litigation. John has been involved in a number of different redistricting cases and can bring that perspective to us here. And then finally, we have Kareem Creighton, who's an associate professor of law at the University of North Carolina School of Law. Kareem is a scholar who looks at law and social science together and has focused a lot on issues around voting and democracy. Being in North Carolina is helpful for that. Let me just get started first by starting with you, John. If you could lay out for us a little bit about the claim that is now with the court. There are a number of claims that were brought here, but what claim are we looking at Wednesday?
Okay. So thanks, Julie, and thank you and OSF for hosting this, as well as thanks to ACS for putting this together and Katie. It's funny that, well, I agree with one of your descriptions of this case as potentially dangerous. I don't know if I would call it fun, and we're going to get into that. It's a very complex case, and I'm going to try to be brief, but also give a little background of what's behind it. This is a case where you essentially have the two political parties in Alabama fighting over white Democratic seats in terms of redistricting. That in Alabama, one of the things that happened, the thing is what the Supreme Court has said is when it comes to the use of partisanship in redistricting, basically anything goes. But when it comes to the use of race in redistricting, there are limits in terms of how far you can go. And so what you have here is you have the Black Caucus and you have the Democrats in Alabama saying too much race was used. But the ultimate end is, frankly, really more of a partisan end than race. And you have the Republicans arguing that they did this for reasons of race. And the rationale doesn't quite stand up. Essentially, what you had here was in the 2000s, Democrats controlled and came up with a redistricting plan that created a number of majority-minority districts. When the Republicans took over in 2010 for this current redistricting, the one that is at issue, what they did is they set out to say that they were going to maintain the same level of black population in the districts that were majority black. And they put that down as being sort of a bedrock principle. And they did all sorts of things to manipulate and keep those districts at the same level because some of them were underpopulated. So in one particularly notable example, there was a district that was underpopulated, and they took white population out of that district and added not only black population to equalize the population numbers of the district for one person, one vote reasons, but population to increase the black population. So the Democratic Party and the Black Caucus, and what they did is they minimized the number of districts that sort of fall in the sweet spot for electing white Democrats, roughly between 30% and 45% black. So what the Democrats and the Black Caucus in Alabama did was they filed a case. As Julie said, there were a whole number of claims. They tried to bring a claim under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. But they couldn't do that because they couldn't come up with plans that actually created more majority-minority districts. So they hit on this claim roughly based on this case called Shaw versus Reno that Katie referred to earlier, where the Supreme Court, in certain circumstances, has said that too much race was used in terms of the coming up with a redistricting plan, and that violates the Equal Protection Clause. The theories are different, though, than in these earlier cases, and we'll talk about the details of that. Both sets of plaintiffs lost in front of the three-judge district court, 2-1. They had two very hostile judges, which comes into play as well because neither party wants to send this case back to the district court. So they appealed. There's a direct appeal to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court agreed to take the case under this theory again that too much race, that race was used in a way that was unconstitutional. Really, really quickly, because it's another complication. What Alabama specifically said, the reason why they were doing this, keeping the black population numbers the same in these districts, was Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Two really quick things. One is that the argument that Alabama has used to do this is a really strained one. The second was, as I think Julie alluded to, the Supreme Court in the Shelby County versus Holder case declared that the formula used for Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act is unconstitutional in 2013, which is after the plan was enacted, but present now. So there's this whole question as, could Section 5 even be a rationale to justify the redistricting plan? So the case is very complex.
Yes, it's very complex, John. So just so it's very, but it's hard to explain. I know it's very hard to explain. But that, as I understand it, and what you're saying here is that the challenge by the black legislators and Democrats is that there were two policy decisions made by the state. One was to preserve the same number of African American controlled districts. Districts that will, where the African American community has the ability to elect their candidates of choice.
Also, majority minority.
But they were majority minority in this case.
Yes.
So, but they made a decision, number one, to preserve the same number of ability to elect districts, and number two, to maintain the same percentage of black voters in each district. So, those two policy choices, as I understand it, are what is being challenged now by the plaintiffs. So, particularly the second one, this idea that you're a policy choice to say I'm going to keep a 57% district at 57 or a 72% district at 72, regardless of what you would need in order for that district to perform for African Americans. That's what's being challenged. So I'm going to ask you, John Gore, is this a Shaw case?
That's a great question.
I think
it is a Shaw case.
Okay.
Because I think that what the plaintiffs fundamentally are trying to show is that the state subordinated traditional districting principles to race, that there was across the plan due to these policy decisions that you've indicated and some other decisions that were made by the state, particularly the 2% population deviation, which we didn't talk about much, but just in broad strokes for in the ordinary course, in a state legislative redistricting plan, the one person, one vote requirement requires that each voter's vote have substantially similar weight. And usually in a congressional plan, what this means is all congressional districts within one state have to have identical population, plus or minus one person, is how that's been understood. In the state legislative redistricting context, however, there can be a deviation of up to 10%, perhaps subject to a caveat, but 10% would be the range within which was more or less a safe harbor, where a state can advance other policy goals, but as long as it stays within that 10%, it's complied with one person, one vote. Here, what the one of the things the legislature did was it adopted a 2% population deviation standard for these plans. Now, that arguably is better compliance with the one person, one vote principle, although there's not really case law saying that. But another interesting aspect of this, since we're talking about this as well as a political battle, is that the 2% population deviation, or at least the state has suggested that standard was to help undo a Democrat partisan gerrymander that was put in place in the year 2000. Because in 2000, as was already mentioned, the Democrats were in control of the Alabama legislature. They had captured about 51% of the vote statewide. and they managed to redistrict in a way that would give them about 71% of the seats. And they did this in part by underpopulating, but still within the 10% deviation, the majority black districts that would be reliably Democratic, and overpopulating a lot of the majority white districts that were going to be reliably Republican. And by doing that, they were able to generate, to leverage the votes they got into kind of a bonus of additional seats, about 20% additional seats. And so in 2010, the state turned around and adopted the 2% population deviation. And part of its rationale to do so was to undo the Democratic gerrymander that had been put in place in the year 2000. That leads to a host of other kind of interesting issues as to the alternative plans in this case and whether the plaintiff's theory is really cognizable under Shaw and under Easley, which I think we'll talk about in a minute.
Yeah, well, what do you think about that? I'm interested. What do you think about whether or not this plan, and maybe I'll ask you, Wendy, do you think that this is a claim, this is like a Shaw claim? I mean, this is very different from a Shaw claim, typically, where you would challenge a district that was drawn within a larger plan, saying that race was the predominant factor, and yet there was no compelling, or even if there was a compelling state interest, it's not sort of narrowly tailored. It's kind of like a strict scrutiny for using race in redistricting. But how is this different?
It's different in a number of respects. I think that the plaintiffs are trying to use the Shaw case, which is usually about the dignitary harm of classifying people based on race, to remedy which is essentially a vote dilution style claim, reducing the political power of African Americans in the context of a court that doesn't recognize vote dilution claims for districts where you can't have a majority minority district. So what they're claiming is the African Americans had the ability to elect the candidates of their choice in these majority minority districts at lower percentages, and in other districts, neighboring districts, they had influence and could combine with white voters to elect white Democrats. And by cannibalizing those African Americans and packing them into the majority-minority districts, they're reducing the influence of African American voters in the neighboring districts and their overall political power. So the nature of the harm they're seeking to remedy is more of a vote dilution style harm. And there's a lot of ways in which this is different. I mean, technically, they're applying the Shaw argument that the racial considerations predominated over other considerations, and they're pegging it on the numerical quota. So overall, as Julie noted, that they rather than performing a detailed analysis looking at a variety of factors, performance, looking at registration rates, looking at other traditional districting factors, they picked a number in advance of where they wanted the African American population to be pegged to, and they're claiming that in and of itself is a quota that is predominating over all other considerations in the redistricting process. And so in that way, it is like a Shaw case, but they're claiming that it is Section 5 rather than Section 2 that drove them to do this. And in that way, it kind of differs also from most Section 5 cases have been to challenge majority-minority districts created under Section 2. Here, it's actually flipped, and they're claiming that in order to comply with Section 5, they had to use race. And that's more of a statewide look. To what extent are we overall reducing the political power of minorities and their ability to elect representatives of their choice? So
right.
I guess it's very convoluted, but I think that it's trying to use Shaw to get at a harm that the court has not recognized in the traditional Section 2 vote dilution context.
Right. So, Kareem, I want to get you in the conversation to see, because North Carolina has had so much litigation since the early 90s around this issue of race and politics and how race can be used in drawing of political districts or in not in drawing districts. And Cromartie, or the Shaw line of cases, Shaw, Miller, Cromartie, is the sort of, that's our kind of Talmud here for how we understand this. So can you maybe help enlighten us a bit about the interplay between race and politics from the court's perspective and how that might impact us in this case?
I'll do my best. So let me...
No, it's a tall order, but you can
right. I'll thank, of course, as everyone else has, Katie and the other good folks here at Open Society, and also ACS for organizing this panel. I'm I could say a number of things about this, but let me just add briefly. I am currently living and working in North Carolina. I'm actually from Alabama. So, yes, there is a lot of this baked in the cake. Yeah. But to answer the question about the connection between race and party, everybody in this case and everybody looking at this case, I think, understands that there is a huge overlap between the relationship between the Democratic Party and being non-white, in particular African-American in the South. Those two are usually groups that travel together. If you're looking for the sort of strongest, most loyal group around in the South, probably for the rest of the country as well, you look for African-Americans. That was true as early as Shaw when the Supreme Court first heard a case out of North Carolina to create this doctrine. And in fact, what this case began as was the Shaw case began as a partisan gerrymandering case. The court did nothing with it. As a racial gerrymandering case, described in the ways that has been, I think, ably discussed so far, the court seemed bothered by the use of race predominating over other considerations. But, of course, you could tell the same story that the court saw in Shaw, where you got a weirdly shaped district with bizarre lines that were inexplicable from their perspective on grounds of race by a party story. White Democrats didn't want to give up their seat. They cut, nipped, and tucked everywhere they could to find black people to comply with the Voting Rights Act. Well, the court seemed not to pay attention to that until it got to this case called Easley versus Cromartie, which was actually just in time for the 2000 redistricting. They settled the 1990s round by having a general exception to the general rule that race can't predominate. So the court basically said, look, we recognize there's this connection, and so if the state can show that its usage of race, its attention to race, wasn't because of race itself, but as a proxy for something else, in this case party, the court says we're willing to kind of wink an eye and say, well, that's okay. But the state does need to show evidence that actually substantiates the connection that it's attempting to draw. And so I think part of the argument here in Alabama is that what wasn't done was the sort of background homework to establish that the African Americans that they were grouping in a particular way in these majority black districts actually had something in common, were performing in a particular way from a partisan perspective that actually led to the creation of the districts. The other big difference, of course, in Easley was in that case you had a Democratic legislature using race, in this case African Americans, as a proxy for finding people that they wanted to put in a district to benefit themselves, right? That is, we're actually trying to help the group that we're targeting. The question here to be asked is whether or not a Republican legislature grouping African Americans who are Democrats, no question about that, should be treated the same under the doctrine when, in fact, what they're doing is grouping them to cabin them, right? So as – I guess that's someone agreeing with me. But to cabin this group to limit their political power. There's no doubt in this on this record, as in North Carolina, every African-American who spoke in the public, every African-American in the state legislature voted against this plan. And so on some level, you could see an argument that, well, the doctrine is the doctrine. It shouldn't matter who's doing the calculation. You should treat the groups the same. But you could see, practically speaking, as Julie mentioned earlier, there are some real consequences. If it's okay to use race as a proxy, even if you're going to limit a group's authority in a dilutive fashion, maybe if we talk about it that way, we may have a very different political dynamic than otherwise. And of course, all of this, to just sum up, is, I think, evidence of two things. One, Justice Kennedy's unwillingness so far to tell us what a partisan gerrymandering standard looks like. In the absence of that, I think we've had this sort of proliferation of different standards to get at this problem that is partisan in some respects. But I also think, frankly, it's the absence of Justice O'Connor who got us going in the Shaw direction in the first place. It was Justice O'Connor who was the decisive fifth vote in Easley versus Cromartie that created this exception. And unfortunately or fortunately, depending on your perspective, Justice O'Connor is no longer on the court and won't hear this case. And so the court hearing this case and working through this problem is a very different court from both Shaw when it was initially adopted, but also Easley. So it's hard to say what's going to happen.
Right, and this court is not necessarily well known for sort of always trying to look at precedent to figure out where they are, so it even makes it more of a bit of a free-for-all. I want to ask you a follow-up question, John, from your earlier comments I thought were very helpful. When you noted that the Section 2 claims, I was just wondering about the Section 2 claim. When you said the Section 2 packing claim failed because of a failure to be able to create more districts, but should that be fatal to a packing claim? I mean, couldn't you, Isn't there a way that you could win on a packing claim without having to establish you could draw more districts just because you're, you know, if you took, isn't that, I mean, I'm, maybe
you
I'm wrong.
Yeah, you don't meet yeah. Jingles 1 unless you can show you can draw more minority districts than already existed. You could bring a claim of intentional discrimination, which is sort of what the plaintiffs have done here. And I'm going to disagree with my panelists as to whether this is a Shaw claim.
Okay, go for it.
Because they haven't styled it that way. Two of my fellow panelists talked about race predominating over traditional districting principles. That's typically the first thing you ask in a Shaw claim. The appellants, that's not the argument they make. You normally have to show that to get to the point of strict scrutiny in the court looking at things more carefully. The plaintiffs want to completely skip that and say, because they had this rule, you already go to more direct scrutiny.
They're not saying, and I just don't know this at all, so they're not arguing that the fact of the rule itself being overtly racial, that is itself sort of evidence that it's predominant factor?
They're not saying it's predominant factor. They're saying you jump, because predominant factor, you have to look at all the factors together, and you have to look at it in the context of a district. In this district, did race predominate? Is it a non-compact district? Is it a district in which precincts were split? These so-called traditional redistricting principles that the court has looked at. Plaintiffs don't want to go into that analysis here. And the argument that the Lawyers Committee made and the argument that the Justice Department made is that's the analysis that should have been applied here. The district court didn't do it. Send it back to the district court. The plaintiffs, both sets of them, do not want to do that.
Why not?
For a very practical reason. They don't like the district court. They think that there are two judges out of three on the district court that are hostile, and so they want the Supreme Court to decide this case. But in terms of doing it, it sets a dangerous precedent in that if you set up a rule that, you know, here you could have other jurisdictions that, you know, now what's common in the South and a lot of local redistrictings is you have a jurisdiction, let's say it's 20% black, there are 5 seats. They agree in advance, we're going to maintain the one majority black district.
At a certain percentage.
At a certain percentage. Majority, you know, a lot of times it's in the 50s. And what I'm concerned that this case is going to do, where the court could go with this, is to say that doing that is presumptively unconstitutional, which would flip the way things have operated for a long time and make it much more difficult to draw a majority black district.
I want to get Wendy in here and John, but one thing I just want to say, because I can't help myself, is that it's part of it to me is not just saying a priori we're going to maintain a performing African-American district. It's actually the number that gets me. To me, it's like the idea that, and maybe I'm the moderator, so I shouldn't have a view, but it's sort of like, to me, it's like, oh, to say it has to be 59, when in fact that district has changed. So this reminds me a lot of like Georgia versus Ashcroft, you know, and sort of all these cases where it's sort of like, well, we're going to assume this whole notion of whether or not the minority community has the ability to elect its candidate of choice is not necessarily a number. It's an analysis. I'm sorry, Wendy, and then I'll go to you, John. Wendy, go ahead.
I wanted to agree and disagree with John. I think that this does differ from most Shaw claims in that they are not doing a district by district analysis in their overall claim. And I think, and that's what the Lawyers Committee and DOJ are suggesting it go remand for. But I don't think that they're claiming that it's not predominant. I think at least factually, the assertion they're making is those two rules, 2%. And maintaining the same percentage as previously were the ones that trumped all other rules across the state. Now, you might have to do a district-by-district analysis to see if that was true, and maybe the remedy is go into particular districts, and if in that particular district that held true, then you would affect it there. But I think the claim is that was an across-the-board rule that they used to trump everything else. And then the issue is the number. And the claim that they're making is this doesn't threaten majority-minority districts. You can still be race-conscious. You can still work towards performance, but you can't actually take a number in advance with without doing that analysis and say as a general matter that number without looking at anything else will be the number that you need. And
okay, go to you, John. Let me do John Gore, and then we go back to you, John.
I completely agree with what Wendy said. I think what you have here is a Shaw claim without having done the Shaw work. Because you have what the plaintiffs are saying is there was a quota for these districts, and what's interesting is that it wasn't a one-size-fits-all quota. Mm-hmm. They're saying there was a quota for each individual district right. that was different and reflected the composition of the benchmark districts.
Right.
And then they're saying, well, if you look at the fact that there was a quota and the outcome that you have a lot of these new districts are either hit on the button, the black voting age population in these pre-existing majority-minority districts or came within a close range, that you therefore it must have been race. And you can infer that there was some kind of subordination to traditional districting principles. And they've made a plan-wide attack, and I thought the Lawyers Committee's brief did an excellent job explaining why that's not how SHOT traditionally operates.
Thank you.
Right.
that it really is district-specific because you have to show that particular lines were drawn to include or exclude a significant number of voters based on race and in subordination to traditional districting principles. Part of the reason why this is a challenge is that for a lot of lay people or people who aren't familiar with this area of law, if you heard that there was a 75% majority African American or majority minority district, you might think to yourself, well, gee, how do you get there? That sounds really high. But given the residential patterns in Alabama, you have counties that are 70 or 75 or 83% majority-minority. And so those districts are what we would call naturally occurring. It naturally occurs when you draw a compact and contiguous district, and you could draw it in complete compliance with traditional districting principles and still have a very high majority-minority composition within the district. And so it's almost like the plaintiffs in this case have failed to do their homework. And I think we'll talk about some of the limitations of their alternative plans at the same a little bit later. Which
go,
I think
go ahead, Kareem. Right, both sides. Like the other side didn't do their homework either, and that's their claim: is you didn't do your homework, and therefore it should fail. And so
I want to get Kareem in here, and I want to ask you, in addition to whatever you want to say, is this just a trick bag for black voters? I mean, I see over time when I look at the arc from Shaw versus Reno to today, and I just kind of feel like here are these black voters all over the country trying to have political voice, and they're different. I mean, the Shaw cases were cases that were determined to be racial gerrymanders by Democrats, and this is an allegation of a racial gerrymander by Republicans. Seems like the people who are being gerrymandered, though, keep being the black voters. So. Yeah. Answer your thing, but is this just a trick bag for black voters?
Well,
we
you know,
sunk.
Yeah, this reminds me of the saying, and I won't say who did it, but someone was told once the Kermit the Frog line, it's not easy being green. Well, it's try being black in the South. It's not always easy. But I think really the choices have been not that different from what you've described, either working within a political party on the Democratic side where you're, you know, responsible for electing a lot of white Democrats who aren't always as responsive, or being a majority in a lot of states where you're a majority of a very small minority party where Republicans are ruling the roost and not really talking to you. I mean, it's a tough call. And the question is who gets to make the call, I mean, from a policy perspective. And, you know, I think what's missing in a lot of these accounts is, again, the fact that African Americans are saying what they want, and it doesn't seem as though law or the court is really listening. Mm-hmm. But I guess I want to go back to the point about whether this is or isn't a Shaw case. Again, Shaw wasn't really clear what it was until Justice O'Connor told us. And so on some level, I think we have to take into account what the court has given us, which is a doctrine that seems to say there's a limit on the extent to which race can be sort of a factor in drawing districts. Whether you think a 75% African-American district is naturally occurring or not is dependent upon the context. What was the district before? What did African-Americans say their community was? And what did the state legislator, whoever they are, do in drawing the district? How did they justify it? I think if you look at Alabama, there's a story that can be told that shows that a significant number of these districts were transformed in ways that haven't existed in that state before. Yes, you can draw a district without picking up a pencil, but no, you can't really justify this, at least in terms of what African Americans said they wanted, nor for that matter whether counties and jurisdictions have been grouped together in the same way as they had in the past. Let me add one other piece to this and talk about North Carolina. You asked earlier about the role that Section 2 plays. in many of these states, Section 5 has done a lot of the major work, and so there hasn't been as much of a need in the redistricting process to rely upon Section 2, because in all cases, the Justice Department would review and make a determination about whether a plan was worse off than before. Julie mentioned the Georgia versus Ashcroft case, which was a Section 5 case. In the absence of Section 5 now, we're talking a lot more about Section 2. But in a state like North Carolina, which is only partially covered, Section 2 actually does a lot more work. And whether you account for the change based on the anti-discrimination rules like the Voting Rights Act or not, North Carolina was electing a good number of African Americans, not just preferred candidates, but African Americans outside of majority black districts. In the North Carolina state legislature before 2010, there were 7 African Americans. Guess how many of them came from majority black districts? None of them. And that plan was supplanted by one in 2010 where Republicans decided they were going to make every district a majority black district. It raises another version of the question that we've been asking. Is there homework that you need to do before determining that the federal law demands that you increase the number of districts beyond the ones that exist now with respect to majority black districts? Those are hard questions, and I don't think that they can be answered with a blanket statement, as you guys were pointing out before. And I wish the court would think some about that. Context matters. Yeah.
No, and the reason why I raised Georgia versus Ashcroft is because the question there about whether or not sort of majority and majority-minority districts are sort of the touchstone, or is it ability to elect, and the revisions to the 2006 Voting Rights Act, you know, Section 5, was all about sort of clarifying that it isn't sort of a magic 50% plus one, but you have to look at performance of the district to see whether or not it can be protected. And so this whole question about whether it's, because when you're drawing bright lines and you're not doing the particularized inquiry about whether or not this is really affording, and again, this is all in the context of RPV, of racially polarized voting, so where you have an African-American community that's not able to elect candidates of their choice because of race. So that's sort of a threshold conclusion in a lot of these conversations, or threshold, conclusion in the beginning is sort of, is there RPV which is stopping the African-American community from having a political voice? And then if so, how do we give them a political voice? So that's kind of what it's about, and what is that political voice? I did maybe go to you, John Gorsuch. You've talked about the North Carolina case and how the 2010 North Carolina map. Could you talk to us a bit about the Virginia map, the post-2010 Virginia map, and how it may be similar or different to this?
Sure. So there is currently before the court the Virginia redistricting case involving the Virginia congressional districts, and it shows a interesting similarity to this case, I guess, in one respect, which is the use of alternative plans. And we've talked a little bit about alternative plans this morning. And so let me touch on that a little bit in the Alabama case and in the Virginia case as well. So ordinarily in these cases, I think the court made very clear and easily some things that we've talked about a little bit here, which is, first of all, because of the high correlation that Kareem talked about between race and political affiliation, plaintiffs bear a burden to decouple the two and show that it was race rather than politics that predominated in the drawing of the district that's under the Shaw challenge. And one of the interesting things about the Alabama case is, as John already mentioned, the plaintiffs in the Alabama case were unable to draw an additional majority-minority district. And in fact, they didn't propose any alternative plans that complied with the legislature's 2% population deviation. All of their plans complied with a 10% population deviation, but not the 2% population deviation that the state said that it preferred for both equal population and political reasons, and that everyone seems to agree, or at least I saw nothing in the briefing disagreeing with the notion that 2% population deviation was non-racial, that it was legitimate in a non-racial principle that the legislature could apply without triggering strict scrutiny all on its own. And so because of that, so easily says they bear this burden, and that you ordinarily prove that burden or discharge that burden through an alternative plan. And because race and politics are highly correlated and you're trying to show a subordination of traditional principles, the alternative plans are designed to isolate race as an explanatory factor. And so what plaintiffs ordinarily do is come forward with a plan that equally complies with the legislature's traditional districting principles and meets the legislature's political objectives, but brings about what the Easley case calls significantly greater racial balance. So it's a plan that removes the racial taint, but still accomplishes the traditional principles and the political goals in the same way as the plan that's being challenged. Now, arguably, that didn't happen at all in Alabama because none of the plans complied with the 2% population deviation. And in the Virginia case, there's a similar issue. And because the plan that was submitted, first of all, the plaintiffs conceded that the challenged plan in Virginia made perfect sense from a political standpoint, because what you have in the Virginia congressional plan is one majority-minority district that's represented by Congressman Bobby Scott. It's surrounded by four Republican districts. So all of the moves that affected the racial composition of those districts benefited the Republican incumbents in the surrounding districts. By shedding Democratic voters into District 3, they became more strongly Republican. By gaining Republican voters from District 3, they also became more Republican. And that was conceded by the plaintiff's expert. Plaintiff's expert then conceded that all of those changes would have made sense if all the affected voters had been of the same race. So conceding that there was the racial component wouldn't have changed what the legislature did in that case. And then interestingly, there was also a concession that the alternative plan itself violated Shaw and subordinated traditional districting principles to race. So I think both of these cases illustrate the importance of the alternative plans, and there may be some fleshing out of what the court meant in Easley when it established this requirement of alternative plans.
Can I ask you a question, because I'm not as familiar with it? So in the Virginia case, did the alternative plan have District 3 with majority African-American population?
Or, yes, it did.
But then did it also have an alternative? I mean, so did it also then have the other surrounding districts? Were any of them potentially ability to elect districts for African-Americans? Like, was there a proposal to draw two, I guess is my question?
There was no such proposal in the litigation. The proposal was to take, so District 3 before the redistricting was about 53% majority African-American.
Right.
It became 56% through the redistricting, through these political changes.
Right.
The alternative plan suggested that it be 50%. And the plaintiff's expert, in fact, said that they had adopted a 50% quota to draw that district, which is interesting because it seems that swapping one quota for another doesn't necessarily solve the problem. But what it did is it increased Democratic voting strength in a neighboring district, not minority voting strength in a neighboring district.
Got it. John Greenbaum, can I ask you about, we talked a lot about the state relying on Section 5, and you mentioned in your overview about that. But, of course, Section 5 is not operable anymore, as you said. So does that fact, even though it's a subsequent fact, how do you think that fact that Section 5 is essentially no longer operable, since there's no longer a formula to determine mm-hmm. who's covered? Mm-hmm. Certainly Alabama is no longer has Section 5 obligations. How does that impact how you think the court is going to see this, if at all?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a problem for Alabama in the court. I think it's going to be hard to – I mean, the court found that the 2006 reauthorization of Section 5 was unconstitutional. So this plan was adopted in 2012. I think the court is going to have a hard time. Given that decision, I think it's going to be very difficult for this court to say that Alabama could use that as a rationale. I mean, this is the one area where the Lawyers Committee and the Department of Justice – and I see some colleagues, some – Department of Justice lawyers here, it's the one place where we took different positions. So the Department of Justice's position is that Section 5 still could be used as a justification because the plan was drawn before the Shelby decision came down.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that the court is going to have to resolve.
Right.
My guess is the court's going to resolve it, given that this is the same court that struck down the constitutionality of Section 5, that the court's going to say, you can't use something that was done in 2012, a plan that was done 2012. You can't use Section 5 as justification.
Even though at the time that was the law?
Right. Because
they don't like it?
No. Well, they found the 2006 reauthorization unconstitutional. So Alabama, although unknowingly at the time,
right,
relied on a statute that was unconstitutional as their justification for doing what they did.
So would that thinking call into question all kinds of things DOJ has done since 2006, objections, you know, all kinds of stuff that they've done under the mandate of Section 5? Would that line of argument, if they took that, just sort of upend everything?
Well, it wouldn't upend everything. It would. It has potential upend objections that were made after 2006.
I mean,
there was a case. So DOJ objected. I'll give you an example. DOJ objected to a change of an election date in, I think it was Augusta, Georgia.
Oh yeah.
Either Augusta or Macon. I
think it was Augusta, Richmond. I know.
Yeah, Augusta, Richmond. And what the legislators had done there was move the election to a date where they figured it would be lower turnout, fewer African Americans would vote. And so that way it would be easier, it would more likely benefit white voters to change the election date. DOJ objected to this. After the Shelby decision, Georgia said, okay, Shelby doesn't exist anymore. And it was done after the 2006 reauthorization. Georgia said, you know what? This is a post-2006 objection. It's no good anymore. We're going forward. Plaintiffs represented by the ACLU filed a suit saying that you can't do this, that objection is still good. They lost in the district court, and ACLU decided not to appeal the case.
Well, I think if I remember correctly, in that case, there was some analysis that was done subsequent that had to do with sort of the on-the-ground facts that were happening in Augusta, Richmond that influenced their decision not to appeal. Not that they, I mean, whatever. But I think that
I don't know why they didn't appeal it.
It's a big question out there. It's a big question out there. If the court were to conclude that things that happened pursuant to Section 5 post 2006 are all null and void, to me, that sounds like chaos. But anyway, I want to go to Wendy for a second.
I just want to point out an irony. There's just that might not be lost on anyone about Alabama actually relying on Section 5 to put forward might be a discriminatory redistricting plan when it itself was the principal cause of the demise of Section 5 that now might make its justification all confused. So,
yeah, that's part of the whole trick bag thing. It's like it's just funny, right? It's funny because you can see why it's done, but it's kind of everybody using these arguments about they're trying to be the ones that are everyone using black voters to their political advantage. Yeah. And then how does the law deal with that? How is the law dealing with this people using black voters to their political advantage? This has been the debate for 20 years. We don't have an answer. Kareem, and then I want to get back to Wendy again.
I'll be brief. There's another answer to this. And dealing with Section 5. It is a weird path, but the court has taken weird paths before. Rather than just as a wholesale matter say that Section 5 was essentially null from the day that it was renewed, one could say instead you can get at this problem by interpreting Section 5 in a different way. Now, it's weird, right? Because it would force the court to go back to Shelby, pretend as though it didn't exist, but actually reinterpret Section 5 as it should have been interpreted under retrogression in, I guess, 2010 when the state of Alabama did the work. You could say that the only thing that Section 5 actually demanded was that you keep things pretty much at the same level, which could have been interpreted the way that Alabama interpreted it. It could be interpreted as to say, look, if you've got a district that's performing, you don't really have to radically change it. Now, if you interpret it in that fashion, you basically preserve the choice that was made, but just say, look, you didn't do it. You didn't do your homework. You didn't do it in the fashion that you should have, which doesn't require you to wholesale get rid of Section 5, because I agree with you. If you do that, you're going to get a ton, I think, of people showing up in court to say, well, this decision was made pursuant to the Justice Department's authority. What do you do with that? I don't know that this court wants to do that. And let me just add, you were talking five members who were all appointed by Republicans. I don't know that a Republican-dominated court with a conservative viewpoint wants to do that, or a small-c conservative court that doesn't want to see a lot of political cases dealt with by the court wants to do that. Now, depending on your perspective, I think that's a problem worth thinking some about.
Yeah, definitely. I wanted to. Thank you. I want to just ask you, Wendy, just given that – so we talked about Shelby versus Holder and Section 5, but there have been a bunch of other things Supreme Court has been doing and the courts have been doing around voting and democracy, and some of which have racial implications, some of which don't. Where does this case, you think, fit into kind of the even bigger picture of what's been happening in the court, Wisconsin, Arizona?
Well, this court has made an agenda around democracy and race and partisanship. It hasn't been very good on those issues, and so that raises a lot of concerns. There are A couple of other cases coming down the pike that raise or raise similar concerns. And as Julie pointed out, there's going to be a number of voting cases that are poised to hit the Supreme Court in granting or denying stays right before the election in Wisconsin, North Carolina, Texas, and Ohio. It made the determination that it was likely to grant cert in those cases if presented. So some of those voting cases are likely to hit the court. Those are similarly cases that involve allegations of discrimination against minority voters, including discrimination for the purpose of advancing partisan political objectives. They are also, like this case, cases that involve claims of pretext. The reason you're doing this is pretextual. And the argument you're making, this is really intentional discrimination. And I think these cases will all. They were all determined to what extent the law will be able to use the law to flesh out and challenge discriminatory laws where you actually can't prove discriminatory intent, but where there's real strong indicia of pretext. And so those are coming down the pike as well. And there's another redistricting case that the court just granted cert that I just wanted to flag, the Arizona Commission case. And here we have a racial gerrymandering claim that is also a partisan gerrymandering situation in the and the court, as you know, has declined to recognize partisan gerrymandering claims, but in Arizona, it's going to the case could go one step, the court could take it one step further and actually prevent states from taking steps to put in place procedural mechanisms to prevent or cabin partisan gerrymandering, because in that case they're challenging a commission that Arizona put in place. So I think that there's a lot of ways in which this court's democracy agenda raises concerns and threats, and this kind of fits right in there.
What do you think about that, John? Because I know the lawyers' committee is involved in a lot of these cases, too. What's your sense of where the court's kind of, how this fits into where the court's head is on this stuff?
Yeah, we have five justices that are very skeptical regarding racial discrimination, especially when the claim is essentially on behalf of minority voters. I think the Wisconsin ID case could serve, frankly, as a trap that... I think that the plaintiffs may go forward and decide that they want to seek cert from the Supreme Court, buoyed by the fact that the Supreme Court granted their stay. With this current court, I don't see the likelihood of success as high. Wendy's organization and mine are two of the many that are litigating the Texas voter ID case. It was very important for us to succeed on a claim of intentional discrimination regarding that claim. Much more difficult for appellate courts to overturn findings of intentional discrimination as opposed to findings of discriminatory result. In Wisconsin, you only have discriminatory result. In Texas, we have this finding of discriminatory intent in a very lengthy opinion. The two other cases, North Carolina and Ohio, are really more at a preliminary stage. They have not been tried yet. Mm-hmm. So they're further along in terms of where their development is. But generally, what I would say, and this applies to areas other than voting, I mean, my portfolio is broader than voting. Right now, there's a case involving the Fair Housing Act that the Supreme Court is hearing as to whether or not the Fair Housing Act recognizes discriminatory, disparate impact claims, in other words, discriminatory effect claims. Every single circuit has said yes. There's no circuit split on this question. The Supreme Court has taken this issue now for the third time. The last two cases, the parties were able to reach a settlement. The Supreme Court is determined to hear this issue. It's hard to not be skeptical in terms of how it's likely to come out. And so it's in a lot of the, and where we try, I mean, some cases like the Shelby County case, You have to, you know, we litigated that case on the defendant side. You have to, it's a pure racial case, and you have to fight using race. Where you have choices of racial versus non-racial theories before this court, your likelihood of success is going to be better if you can have a non-racial theory, which is what we had last year in the case Arizona versus ITCA. We were able to get 7 votes from the court on a non-racial theory.
Somewhat reluctantly from the court. You can see Justice Scalia is not wanting to vote for you. Yes, Wendy.
Just, one of the connections that John was alluding to just make it more explicit is that both the redistricting cases and the voting cases viewed in light of the court's grant of repeated grant of cert in the Fair Housing Act cases present a risk that the court's going to do damage to Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and its results claim, and that's sort of what the effort to cabin, because this court has not been very favorably disposed towards the Voting Rights Act or towards non-discriminatory intent claims. It's very different, the Voting Rights Act, from disparate impact claims. It has a lot of other elements that would, you know, differentiate it, but that's the... But that is the thing that ties the risk, the dangers of these cases all together.
John Gore, I want to get you in here for a second to talk about Justice Kennedy, if you don't mind.
Okay. Do my best.
Because it seems to me it's funny. I mean, Justice Kennedy, we're always, those of us who are on the pro-civil rights, you know, world, we're always laser-focused on Justice Kennedy, right? Because we see him as the way we could get, I mean, it's true, ITCA was different because it was a very different kind of case. But generally, on civil rights cases, we're looking at Justice Kennedy, and he has in the past shown, in my view, a willingness to see racial discrimination and a willingness in the Texas and the round of redistricting after the 2000 round. It was Justice Kennedy who wrote the decision in GI Forum. What's the other name for it?
Lulac
versus Perry. And Lulac versus Perry to say, it looks like Texas is intentionally discriminating against Latino voters. And trying to find low-performing Latino voters and swap them for other high-performing Latino voters in order to let them not realize their political power. He has some great line in there, which I don't remember. It's something about just as Latinos were on the cusp of exercising their political power, the state took it away from them. So he can see that. He's even seen that in an odder way, but in the education cases, where he wants to see, sees race discrimination, but then isn't always comfortable with race-conscious remedies, though he can see it. So here, do you think, but he's also the political gerrymandering guy, like, yeah, I think there's a political gerrymandering claim that could be heard, but I haven't seen one yet. And I think it's possible, but I haven't seen it yet. So help us with the psychology here, or the jurisprudence, or the way of thinking about this.
I'm most definitely not a psychologist, but
shouldn't we all have been psychologists first? That's what I think.
I think that Justice Kennedy embodies a lot of hopes and aspirations of any party who thinks the case might be decided 5-4.
Right. That's right.
In any event, I think on you're right on some of these civil rights cases, particularly Lulac and everything you said, I think accurately describes his jurisprudence. I think another interesting element of it, though, gets back to the Section 5 question, because in Georgia versus Ashcroft and in Bush versus Vera, he wrote concurring opinions that basically said, "I'm leaving my options open.
Right.
I haven't committed one way or the other to whether or not the mere invocation of Section 5 or the use of race to comply with Section 5 automatically triggers strict scrutiny." Which I think is an issue that we were batting around here earlier today.
Right.
He also, however, hasn't always been very hospitable to the idea of minority influence districts.
Right.
And I think that's something you might see here again, because you have in the Alabama case a fight about white Democratic seats. That's what, as John framed it at the beginning, that's what the parties are fighting about here. Should there have been white Democratic seats preserved, maintained, or created in this plan? And, of course, to get there, those are really what are sometimes termed in the literature these influence districts. They're not majority-minority, but it's a sufficient minority population that you can guarantee the election of a white Democrat with crossover and coalition voting. So I think you're absolutely right. But there are kind of competing forces, I guess, pulling on Justice Kennedy in this case, and it's not clear to me exactly how he's going to view this and which of those forces will win out.
Kareem, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, let me just sort of add to what John said in reference to cases. I mentioned earlier that Justice Kennedy was not in the majority on the case Easley versus Cromartie, where Justice O'Connor says you can use race as a proxy for partisanship. Oddly enough, though, another case that Justice Kennedy actually wrote was Bartlett versus Strickland, a case out of North Carolina, which is, in my case, in North Carolina, a situation where the Democrats tried to draw a district that was not a majority African-American district and said, look, Section 2, we think, justifies the drawing of this district. Justice Kennedy says, no, we want to adopt a bright-line rule that establishes, essentially, if you want to utilize Section 2, you can only draw a majority black district, at least I'm very much simplifying it, but that's mostly what he said. But he had a bunch of warnings about utilizing that as a talisman, that, you know, forced the state in all circumstances to maximize the available number of majority black districts. So on one level, it seems to suggest that Kennedy wants a very limited use of race in the ways that John suggested. But on the other hand, it offers some sense that maybe he appreciates the need for context. That is, there are instances where you need it, but you should use it in very limited circumstances. And we don't want to overrule the possibility that influence is one way of realizing black political power. And I think, frankly, the debate so far, unfortunately, has been between using black majority districts all the time and none of the time. And I think the world exists where we both, all of us, I think, live in the middle, where some places it makes the most sense. If you live in Mississippi this day and age, racially polarized voting is so significant that outside of a majority black district, you're not going to get any candidate you prefer, black or white, elected if you're a member of the black community. There are other circumstances where it's less so. But the question is, again, going back to the earlier point, are you doing your homework to figure out which part of the spectrum you live in?
Right, and making assumptions about, and I think a lot of us sort of just bristle at this idea of making assumptions about black voters or white voters, right, just because they're black or just because they're white or just because they're Latino. And sort of wanting to sort of, this whole idea that I'm always thinking about is the idea of political voice and equality in political voice. Well, to know that, you have to kind of know your community and know who your voters are and know, you know, whether or not they are blocked out and are they a community. And sort of getting away from this, that I think a lot of us talk about a lot, getting away from this sort of stereotyping people, but also then at the same time being able to recognize when they are a community and when they do have a cohesive voice, and that is being kind of snuffed out. Wendy, did you want to add something?
I just want to add that both the plaintiff's theories and the lawyer's committee theories offer the appeal to Kennedy based on fact-finding and this need to do the homework, the need to actually look at the circumstances on the ground to recognize changed circumstances and to be sensitive to the actual communities. One does it in the front end and one does it by sort of in its critique of what the state did, and one does it in what the analysis should be. But both of them, I think, are appealing to that concern of Justice Kennedy's, and I think both have that chance of succeeding as a result.
I want to ask, I have one more question, then I'm going to open it up for questions here from the group. But when I look at this kind of case and have this kind of discussion, which I think has been so helpful for me and hopefully for other people too, that it just strikes me that none of, and I know people talk about this a lot, but I'm just going to say that none of these justices, except for really Justice Kagan, have any political experience, right? Justice Breyer, a little bit. Justice Kagan, a lot more. But a lot of them don't. And the sort of push and pull and up and down and the sort of the gritty kind of stuff that is politics seems so much what's going on here. I mean, how important is it for us to think about, those of us who are working in the political equality world, to think about sort of how much harder it is or what we can do about it or how we can raise this idea that if you're going to be judging around politics, you should know it before you can judge it, at least a little bit, or at least not think that it's something foreign and weird and just something that craven people do, right? And I speak, of course, as someone who does politics all the time. Yes, Wendy, what do you think about this?
I think that that's a good argument for diversity of experience on the bench. I think it's and I think that that does color and distort the jurisprudence and lead to decisions and doctrines like the ones we're discussing that don't make a whole lot of sense and that are hard for people in the real world to work with.
Yeah, I mean, the Supreme Court justices, in fairness to them, I mean, they're generalists. They dip into this, they come in with certain ideas, certain world viewpoints, which affect the way they decide cases. But, you know, you think there was that case last year having to do with genetics. And even there, they clearly admitted that they were way out of their depth in terms of trying, you think of the breadth of decisions
yeah.
and topics that they have to cover in a given year, and you know, it would be mind-boggling to be in that position of to try to figure all the stuff out. So, I mean, Julie, your basic point is, yeah, I mean, it is a disadvantage that we have justices that are making these decisions regarding an issue where race and politics are really intermingled, and there's no political background in there that they can draw from.
Unlike genetics, it's like a whole branch of government. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? It's like a whole thing, and it just seems like it's such an important branch of government to understand before you start making rules for how it should operate. But that's my editorializing. Okay, so now let's open up for questions from the group. Anybody have a question? Just raise your hand. Yes. Oh, wait, there's a mic coming for the taping, I think.
You mentioned that this case could potentially be dangerous, and I haven't gotten quite a sense yet of what that looks like. Can you kind of explain the worst-case scenario? Is this like Shelby of last year? Can it be that broad, or does it have a more limited impact, even if in the worst-case scenario? You know, how bad could it be?
All right, since I called it dangerous, I'm going to take the first shot at this. I think what, you know, I've worked in the area of minority voting rights for the last 17 years. I think the danger in this case is that the Supreme Court could say it's presumptively unconstitutional to draw majority minority districts. I think that's how far that they could go. And that's my concern, and even the concern about the discussion that we've been having, where are the presumptions? Right now, the law is in such a way that it's presumptive. The redistricting plan is presumptively constitutional, and the plaintiffs have to do something to show that it's not. And what concerns me about this case is that the court could say, drawing any line that creates majority-minority districts, there's a presumption of unconstitutionality, and states and local jurisdictions have to affirmatively prove that there's a reason why they did this. And because what will happen then is that many states and localities are going to say, oh, we're going to jump off of this boat because the presumption is that this is unconstitutional. And I think, you know, unfortunately, most of the cases the Supreme Court takes are statewide redistricting cases. And the dynamics of local elections are so different than when you're doing statewide redistricting, because party has a much stronger impact in terms of what's happening on a statewide level than what's happening in local elections.
Anybody else want to comment on that?
I think the other, I guess, version of the danger, I probably wouldn't exactly put it the way John did, but I wouldn't largely disagree with it either. But again, the simmering issue also is partisan gerrymandering. I think we all recognize there's a story to be told for that here. Just as there is in just about every one of these cases. And we know that at least 3 to 4 justices are of the view that we should never have a Supreme Court doctrine to police that issue. Justice Kennedy says, you know, from my view, thankfully, well, that might be a claim out there. We don't know what it looks like. Feel free to bring me some options. Right. And it may be the time where he throws up his hands and says, well, enough already. But yeah. I hope not. I don't think so. But that's the danger, I think, lurking in all these cases.
But on the upside, he could say, okay, so now I've seen a political gerrymander that I recognize. And
right.
This is a political gerrymandering case. John?
The 5-second thing.
Yeah.
One of the things that's interesting is the same justices who say there's no political gerrymandering say that there's racial gerrymandering. And you think about that one. And the justices who in the Shaw cases were coming out and saying and came out against the racial gerrymandering claims are the ones who say you can have partisan gerrymandering claims.
Wendy?
I just want to add that one of the reflections of the danger is over and over again, the Supreme Court has assumed that compliance with the Voting Rights Act provides a compelling state interest for race-conscious actions. It has never affirmatively held that, and a couple of the justices have repeatedly dissented on that. And so that's really sort of the sort of lurking danger is that they're going to reach that question. And they've already expressed their doubts about part of the Voting Rights Act. And the fear is that they'll doubt more of the Voting Rights Act.
Right. I think that's right. Lots of fears, but one opportunity. Anybody else have a question? Yes, sir. Here comes the mic.
John Gore had mentioned the Virginia redistricting case that's going on as well. And I know that case has been appealed to the Supreme Court. Do you have any feel on how this case ends up affecting potential cert or the outcome of that case at all?
I don't know that it has much, if at all. I can't prognosticate how this case is going to come out. But I would think, given the clarity of the issues in the Virginia case, what happens in this case would not necessarily be controlling in that one.
And one procedural thing, because it's the Supreme Court, it's not a cert case. This is a three-judge redistricting case. I mean, for statewide redistricting cases, there's a special rule where you have a three-judge district court. It's a direct appeal to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has to affirmatively do something. They don't necessarily have to have full briefing and argument. They can decide it on a summary basis, but they have to do something, and it makes it very different than, let's say, the things like the ID cases and other cases that come before the court.
Do you think the court wanted this case?
The Alabama case?
Yeah. I mean, I know they had to take it, but do you think they wanted it? Or they were like, oh, my God.
You have at least four justices that wanted it because – well, actually, you're right, because it's appeal. I think on some level they must have, because it's something that they could have dealt with it on a summary basis. They could have said something like, we remand and ask the district court to apply the rules in Miller versus Johnson. They could have done something like that on a summary basis, but they decided that they wanted to hear.
It's so
argument.
Complicated because even to do that, they'd have to then acknowledge it's a Shaw claim. And so it was sort of they may have found themselves in kind of a difficult spot, like how do we dispose of this quickly? Maybe we can't, you know, bring it on.
One of my colleagues still has a dream that one day the court will say that they improvidently took this case for hearing an argument. I don't think that's going to happen.
Bob?
Yes.
Yeah,
I did want to just add one kind of other note to the dangers. The dangers are all sort of assuming that the court takes the case a lot farther than on its face it ought to go, that they are dangers that would represent a kind of big step and overreach by the court. The case presents narrower questions, and so while those dangers are in part what are motivating these fears, I think that would be an overstep. And by the court.
Yeah, Kareem?
Julie, I want to go back to something else that you all were going back and forth about regarding what is missing in the court that's hearing this case in terms of the expertise, if you will. Justice O'Connor, when she was on the court, was the only person who had actually served in a state legislature. She had been a state senator in Arizona and actually was in charge of redistricting. I'm not a defender of Justice O'Connor's treatment of redistricting cases, but it does, I want to suggest, offer another way in which I think this court is deficient and could use more of. I mean, we talked about a lot of different ways in which it was relevant to have people who brought experiences. I think it's relevant to be a person who actually is a part of the kinds of groups that are at issue in this case. And we do have at least one member who grew up in a Section 5 jurisdiction who, again, I don't necessarily agree with, but I do think it says something when you hear the court talk about issues regarding race, where you have a person on the court who can talk about what it means to be a part of the excluded or marginalized group. And if you look at, by the way, there's a really great biography on Justice Sotomayor, for those who haven't seen it, and if you've sat in on some of these cases, I think she speaks quite persuasively in ways that are quite powerful. And I don't think this is just symbolic. I think when you're talking about political power and what it means to express political power in different circumstances, it actually means something to be a part of these groups, to know what is real and what is sort of imagined. And I don't think, frankly, that a lot of the discussions as of yet have really engaged that so much. I'd like to see more of that happen. The aspiration would be that this case would invite that, but we'll see.
Yeah. Another question from the audience? Yes, sir, right here.
Your mic. So, notwithstanding what was said before about this not really being a pure shock that way, I'm curious if all we get at the end of the day, the court has either made it a little bit harder to trigger strict scrutiny context in which these issues arise, would we be able to say that one is better?
Yeah. So I'll answer the question this way. In an area, and given my skepticism of the Supreme Court, in terms of, and I'm not saying anything negative about them as people. It's just the way that the majority views the issue of race. I think the status quo is better than something new that's out there. And you know, what we essentially argued for in the Department of Justice is just apply things the same way, make the district court go back and apply the same rules that you've been using. Don't create new rules, because I think new rules are potentially dangerous and will be set forth in a way that in all likelihood is not going to be good for minority voters. Now, sometimes you can turn lemons into lemonade. I mean, we had a case a number of years ago where we used the Bush versus Gore theory against Ohio and the way it administered elections. But I'm less hopeful that the Supreme Court coming out with something new and different here is ultimately going to be good for minority voters.
If I could chime in on that, I think if the premise of the question is that there will be something new, it'll either be something that's a little bit easier to trigger strict scrutiny or a little bit harder. I don't think we know the answers to whether or not that would be better for minority voters, or at least it's not obvious to me. And I do think, to pick up on that and a theme that's been talked about in this panel more generally, I think it's far more likely than not that the Supreme Court is going to find some narrow way to resolve this case. We talked about a lot of the fears that are out there about, you know, what if they, you know, decide to invalidate the 14th Amendment or
whatever issue we think they might want to do.
Of course, no one said that, but that there might be implications for Section 5 and these other kind of approval decisions that have been made. I think this is a court, both because it's politically conservative, as Kareem noted, and also small-c conservative, I think it does a pretty good job overall of taking cases and trying to find a narrow way to resolve them. And I think there are a lot of those that present themselves in this case, some of which we've talked about, because of how it's been litigated.
Yeah.
And I think that may allow the court to skirt or avoid or not even have to deal with a lot of the issues that we've talked about may be bigger picture implications.
Yeah. Kareem, did you add anything to that?
Okay, so I'm just going to take the other side, being the academic that I am. I don't necessarily disagree with that. I do, however, think that we've seen indications that the Chief Justice has, I think, great ambitions for what he wants to make his mark on the court. And I think in some ways the Democratic talk is part of that story. I mean, we've heard part of the story being told with respect to race discrimination, disparate impact cases and the like. But I don't know that we know what he wants to do. But I think, you know, cases like these give us kind of good data points. But it could well be that where, you know, cases don't present the opportunity, you get small-c conservatism. But if you, you know, if you're going to be on the court for a long time, you see, you know, the world being more or less your oyster, your ability to put your imprint on what you think the law ought to be, cases like these offer an opportunity. Whether it comes in this case or another case, I think that's where we end up watching, you know, the details right. of how cases get resolved to see where it goes.
All right, just to sort of flesh that out a bit, because I think that's right, because, you know, the Chief Justice has a plan, you know, and he plants seeds that grow later.
Sure.
And we've seen him do that already just in the short time he's been on the court, relative short time he's been on the court, that I think the thing to look out for those of us on the side of disagreeing with him a lot, are the seeds that he plants in this decision, and then what the ramifications of those, you know, what little trees are going to come out of that. Yes, Wendy?
The court hasn't taken small c conservative steps in the democracy context.
Nope.
Generally. This is, you know, that's the one main exception to the baby steps, and unless you call Nemudna a baby step to Shelby County, but
that
it was
like
a
seed. That was a seed.
Yeah, that does not
just grow a tree later.
That was Citizens United. If you see the way that case came up out of nothing, the way the court forged the case, that it wasn't presented before it. This is an area where the court has an agenda. Is this a particular manifestation of it? I don't know.
Right.
But the sort of broader democracy area, and at least if you look at the campaign finance and the voting context and the fact that the court now has two redistricting cases, and in the Arizona one they could have more likely actually avoided that case, the court might be looking to, to make a broader imprint on the redistricting area as well.
Yes, Karine.
I promise to be brief about this, but I don't mean to be Debbie Downer in all of this. I actually think anytime the court sort of begins to theorize in an area, it's an opportunity to educate, right? To actually pull the court in directions that maybe it doesn't anticipate it needs to go in, but based on new facts and new cases, it wants to kind of bring all of this stuff together and harmonize. I actually think what is missing from this account, in many cases where redistricting is at stake, you have parties going after each other, you have legislative black caucuses going after the state, and again, I have views in all of these cases, but I think what's missing is a voice of the public. Julie has termed it with respect to the African-American community, which is, again, kind of a missing element in this case per se. But
true.
We see a number of these opportunities where the court can be presented with an argument that the public wants their democratic system organized a certain way. In Arizona, right, there's an argument that the Independent Redistricting Commission is sort of the placeholder for what the public wants and not what political parties or interest groups
right.
want. So it might be an invitation for the court to say, all right, we may not be that comfortable dealing with race, but where the public has decided, this, among other things, should be some of the consideration that we put into how we draw districts or organize any other number of political regulations, maybe we'll be willing to play in that sandbox. So, again, this is not necessarily Pollyanna-ish. It's instead, though, to say there's a realistic possibility that the court can be drawn with other arguments.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point, Karim, right, because this issue came up also in Georgia versus Ashcroft.
Sure.
The issue of, the African-American legislators versus the African-American community, and is that, do they have the same interests? Any more questions? We have time for another question. Yes, here comes the mic.
I'm curious what the role is, if anything, it's probably not on the record, but in terms of understanding the circumstances on the ground there, in terms of felon disenfranchisement and reapportionment based on that principle. I was just listening, coincidentally, to Brian Stevenson yesterday, and he was discussing, not in Alabama, but in Arkansas, that the black male population is disenfranchised by a rate of 34% based on the strict felon laws there. And I would imagine that the Arkansas felon disenfranchisement statute would be similar.
I'm happy to answer. Just briefly.
Yep.
That is yet another of the places where I think the ongoing conversation is moving, I think, in a positive direction. The story in Alabama isn't all that different. The effect of these disqualification laws pretty much has roughly the same effect on the African-American male population, but African-American population more generally. Women are less likely than men in that population to be affected by the laws, but, overall the community is affected. A lot of Republican legislatures, and I give credit where it's due, sort of recognize that actually it's bad business. Well, some of them have recognized it's bad business to continue to warehouse people in jails. California, even though it's not a Republican legislature, has sort of led the way in some ways of saying, look, we're not going to continue to warehouse people and keep them out of the political process because of imprisonment and felon disenfranchisement. I think it's slowly moving into places that are traditionally red, but how we utilize law to get at this as opposed to sort of the political process and passing new laws and policies, I'm not so sure. The court at present isn't in the place of utilizing the Voting Rights Act or certainly not the Constitution to rule these as a categorical matter, these disqualification laws unconstitutional. But they certainly are, I think, part of the story and why the political process looks the way that it looks, both racially who shows up and who can't show up at the polls, but also in some respects the interests that get represented and the people who show up in the state legislature. But, yeah, it's one of the things that I look at it you're likely to see the most traction in lobbying state legislatures and governors. I mean, we now have presidential candidates on the Republican side talking about this. Where the conversation goes, I think, is still open, but it's definitely ripe for a conversation.
Okay, that's great. Well, we're going to end it there and thank our fantastic panelists for a really great discussion. Thank you all very, very much.